Hello, pals of mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. When I was really little, one weekend my family was visiting my grandparents who lived out of town in the country. My dad and my uncle had returned to the house rather late after allegedly running some errands. I don't remember the entire storied excuse my dad used, except the part when he described a tarantula which was as big as a car. I had no idea what a tarantula was, and I was certainly unfamiliar with exaggeration. So until I actually saw a tarantula several years later, I had an underlying fear of them. My grandfather and his siblings, and their children, often told tall tales around the campfire. Even today, there's a bit of disappointment if a story doesn't have some crazy nonsense or BS aspect to it. The Sacramento Storytellers Guild is composed of retirees who have accumulated years of personal experiences and folk tales. This month, the theme is summer vacation.
My name is Philip Eugene Drexler, and I bought this hat in Austin, Texas. That's why it's Longhorn Burnt Orange. Though I am not a Longhorn, I am a Sooner. I grew up in Oklahoma City, and I used to love to wear my Sooner hat around the UT campus. You'd be amazed how intelligent, educated people will look strangely at you because of a stupid cap. But anyway, Larry had a theme of summer vacation, so this is a story about a summer vacation, but it's a lot bigger than that. Just about 37 years ago, I sat in the basement of my split-level house in Denver, Colorado. I was 15 years old. And I watched the Belmont Stakes. And I watched Secretariat win the Triple Crown. Now, I'd never been a whole lot of a animal lover or a horse lover in particular. But when I saw that horse win by 31 and a half lengths, and when that track announcer said as he came around the head of the stretch and it was obvious he was going to blow the field away, "He's a tremendous racing machine." Well, I just lost it. I cried. Cried all the way through the finish line and for several minutes thereafter. I could not believe that an animal could do something like that. It was absolutely astounding to me. Did you know that Secretariat's heart, it was twice as large as a normal horse's heart? That's how he was able to pump out that tremendous oxygen as he raced. Now, that had been 25 years since there'd been a Triple Crown winner when Secretariat won that race. And you know what? Every time I see that clip, I cry. Every time I see that clip. And he says, "He's a tremendous racing machine." I start crying. So, I liked horses until I went on summer vacation, probably a month after the Belmont Stakes, summer of 1973. And my parents took me on one of those trail rides. Now, the guys that ran that trail ride, they were your typical, you know, aw shucks, gee whiz, thank you ma'am kind of cowboys. And they seemed friendly and genial enough. So when they hoisted me up onto that horse, I thought, well, you know, this is going to be all right. They're going to be right there. It'll be fine. No problem. So we commenced to start clopping on down the trail. My mother and father were ahead of me. My brothers and sister were ahead of me. We got into a little clearing there in the middle of the forest there in Colorado where I lived. And that horse commenced to live up to his name. Because his name was Tornado. And that's exactly what he did. He started spinning and twirling and whirling around in a circle. And I felt my stomach come up into my throat. And I thought I was going to die. I was trying to pull on those reins like those all Chuck cowboys told me to do, but it wasn't doing no good because the vortex was getting tighter and tighter. Right about the time I thought, well, he's going to spin me right off of him, and that'd probably be a good thing, he decided he had enough of being a tornado, and he took off like a hurricane through the forest. The pine needles scraping my hands and feet and face as we plowed through the forest. Probably only lasted 30 or seconds or so. You know, those aw shucks cowboys, you know, they didn't want anybody to get hurt, so they were chasing after me, and they got a hold of me pretty quick. But by the time they did, I was across a little stream and half wet as well. And I looked back, and there was my mother and my father on the other side of the stream. And it felt like they were a million miles away. It was a pretty traumatic experience. I'd been through some trauma a couple of years before, and it was to such an extent that I quit talking for a year or two. I would talk to my mother, and that was about it. We had a Bible study in our house once a week, and the conductor would come every week, and he would say hello to me every time he came in the door. And I stared at him with a stone face. Finally, one day, I said hello to him, and I thought the world had come to an end. Everybody broke down in jubilation because I had spoken again. My mother had put me in a therapeutic recreation program in the spring of that year, 1973. And it was designed to get me out of my shell, and it did. That socialization was just the thing that a nine-year-old needed. Broke the ice. Looking back in retrospect as a professional, the only thing that was wrong with it was that it was all competitive sport. So it made me incredibly ambitious, which is good and bad. But anyway, it worked. So I was able to cry when Secretariat ran that amazing race, and I was able to feel something when that horse went to spinning on me. It was kind of a breakthrough, actually. Made me remember what had caused me to quit speaking in the first place. And even though I forgot it again for several decades, when I met a young woman who was a horsewoman and she got to talking about Secretariat, I was reminded that, yeah, that's what it all had happened to me. So it was kind of like coming full circle, sort of like a tornado. So anyway, that's my story for today. Now, if you want to know something about me besides what I've already told you.
You're from Oklahoma, you said.
I grew up in Oklahoma City, and I'm an Oklahoma Sooner fan. And I became a Baltimore Orioles fan when they won the World Series in 1966 because I was 8 years old. And they beat Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale. And they had the coolest black and white uniforms in the major leagues. So I became a Baltimore Orioles fan. Which was interesting because my father was a Boston Red Sox fan, and his father was a New York Yankees fan. Now, they're all perfectly logical reasons for each of us picking those teams, but I have to say, individuation from the father figure, I'm sure that played a role in all of those decisions.
Let's see. How did you get to California?
Oh, there's a lot in between here and there. I grew up in Colorado, as you heard from the story. And then I moved to Texas when I was 15, and I lived in Texas for 40 years. Yeah, I love Texas. I got back into storytelling. When I was little, I would wear a little hat like this, actually a little plaid hat like this, and I would wear a little suit, and I would go around telling little stories and singing little songs. And my siblings started calling me Pink Crosby.
Cute.
But that trauma that happened when I was 7 or 8, you know, kind of knocked that all out of me. And I got back to it when I was working at the state hospital in Austin about 15 years ago. And I said, I'm a recreation therapist who has no hobbies. What hobby do I want to pursue? So I looked through all the lists, you know, and everything, and nothing seemed particularly appetizing to me. But as I was digging through the computer there looking for a hobby, I found this old story that I had written when I went back to college. I went back to college when I was 35 years old because I'd done volunteer ministry work for 17 years before that. And it was a story about a little town near Lockhart, Texas called Sea Willow, Texas. And I actually entered it in a little literary contest over in Kyle, Texas at the Catherine Ann Porter Childhood Home. If you've never read Catherine Ann Porter, one of the finest short story writers you'll ever read, especially a story called The Grave. It's my favorite short story of all time. And so I was quite honored when I won that award. I won the Catherine Ann Porter Literary Prize in 1994. But, you know, I stuffed that back in a closet somewhere and had to go back to work, you know, after I got out of school. Forgot about it. But when I was digging around looking for a hobby, there was that story on the computer. And I said, heck, I'm a storyteller. I was a storyteller when I was a kid. I should do storytelling again. So that's how I got back into storytelling.
There's the tornado again, full circle.
Absolutely. So to answer your question, I moved to California 6 months ago because I'm a recreation therapist, and I've been working at Sacramento State Prison for the last several months.
Little town where I live, it was called Diego Martin, but in a different country, a different time, in local parlance, it was called Diego Martin. Okay? So there I lived, there I was, 9 years old, just like Philip, and school was coming to a close, and we had 6 weeks. We only had 6 weeks vacation, 6 weeks looming in front of me. Well, for that 6 weeks, my parents decided to send me off to my grandparents who lived out there in the boondocks. Now, 9 years old, if you're driving for an hour and all you can see is one cow, it's out there in the boondocks. If you're driving for an hour and a half and you see one chicken sitting on the fence, it's out there in the boondocks. Well, I go out there and there are my grandparents and there's me. And there's the little farm, you know, and there are things to do for the first couple of days. It's exciting, you're exploring, but there are no other kids, you know. I come from a town where we have kids on that side and kids on that side and kids across the street, and you walk to school with a bunch of kids, and you come home for lunch with a bunch of kids, and you go to church like in a posse, you know, you just everybody in the neighborhood going together, and there I am, you know. What do? Contemplate the sky, you know, play with the dog, pick up the ticks from the dog, eat good food, you know, I wasn't getting any bigger. And one day, I decided to go fishing all by myself. There's a little stream, it wasn't anything big, but, you know, I made me my little rod, which was a long stick and a string and a safety pin attached to the end, and have my bucket and I go fishing. Well, I have to entertain myself, okay? And I go there day after day. At 9 years old, it's hard to tell how long. I go there day after day, and one day I actually catch a fish. You know, and the fish is about, I could do the fish story and say it was that big. But in reality, it was a little fish. And I took this fish off this hook, and I'm like, oh, he's such a cute fish, and put him in a bucket of water and took him home. Well, I took this fish home, and he's too little to get eaten, you know? And so that night, I put a bucket with the fish next to my bed, and put a little bit of zucchini in it, you know, so the fish can eat, you know? And that was good. The next morning I got up, there's this fish swimming along looking really happy. Water is a little murky, changed the water. And now I had me a pet. I had a pet fish in a bucket next to my bed. I would take this bucket with me all over. Doing my chores, there's my bucket with the fish. They drew the line at taking the fish to church. Okay, they said no fish. But anyway, I love this fish. One morning I got up and the fish, I looked in the bucket, fish wasn't there. And I'm like, oh! So I start looking around and there is this fish lying on the floor next to the bucket. So I pick him up and I put him back in the bucket. And I get there changing my clothes and I hear plop. I look in the bucket. The fish has jumped out of the bucket again. So I go and I get a bigger bucket, more water, put the fish carefully in there. I get dressed. I go to the bathroom. I come back. I look in the bucket. Fish isn't there. Fish is out of the water on the floor. I'm like, pick him up again, put him in the bucket, headed out to the kitchen, and I'm hearing slop, 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 slop. And I look back, and there is the fish following me. Wet trail, his tail flapping, flop, flop. And I'm like, this is a weird fish. Pick up the fish and put him in the bucket, and I put a lid over the bucket. Well, have breakfast, and I come back, and I'm hearing, So I take the lid off, fish flops out, and he's following me around while I make the bed, while I tidy the room, and I'm like, if you don't want to stay in the water, that's your problem. Leave the fish out. I go out of the house, and there's this fish following me. Well, I thought maybe, hey, this is kind of cool. Maybe I could put a leash on the fish. Yeah. Well, I tried that. It was kind of slippery. It didn't work. Okay. So all summer now, I have this fish following me all over the place. And at night, I would put him back in his little bucket. And every morning I got up, he would be out of the bucket like a good little dog for a good little fish waiting for me. Well, that 6 weeks was really moving fast. My parents came to visit just about a week before school started. And because I wasn't privy to the grown folks' conversation, I had no idea what they were talking about because I was busy having fun with my fish outside. And so I didn't have time to eavesdrop, you know, like nine-year-olds want to do. Yeah. But when I came back in, I heard that I was going to stay and live with Grandma and Grandpa while Mom and Dad went off to seek fame and fortune, and they would come back and get me at the end of the school year. Well, I wasn't too unhappy. I had me a pet. I had a fish following me all over the place. So we went shopping, I got new school clothes, I got new shoes, we got books, we got everything, and came the first day of school. Now, I have to walk to school, and I have to tell you this, it was 5 miles uphill to the school, and 5 miles uphill home. It was one of those schools. So I take off bright and early, because you have to walk to school. Actually, it was probably less than that, but you know, 5 miles sound good, right? 5 miles, yes, yeah, in the wind and the rain, and I'm going to school, and the fish has followed me out of the house. I go down the path to the gate, and the fish is following me, and I turn back and I say, no, you can't go to school. Sort of like Mary had a little lamb, you know, tried to follow me to school one day, and I was like, I run back in, I put the fish in the bucket, and I rush out of the house, and there's the fish, flop, 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 flop. And I'm like, finally, I says, you know, I'm going to be the new kid if I show up with this nice new pet, you know. I'm going to be popular. So then we come to the stream, and I'm crossing the little bridge, and there's a hole in the bridge. And of course, 9-year-old, I jump over the hole, and I look back, and I see my fish try to jump over the hole. And since he was such a small fish, he jumped right into the hole, down into the water, and he drowned. That was the end of my pet.
pretty fishy.
I went to school. I was very sad. I came back home and I told my grandparents that my fish had drowned. They didn't believe me. They said, quit telling stories. But to this day, it is a story, and it is a good story.
So tell me a little about where you grew up.
I grew up in the West Indies, in Trinidad, country of Trinidad and Tobago.
And you were an only child?
Oh, no. I'm one of three, actually.
And where were you in the lineup?
Number one.
Ah, firstborn.
Yeah. Yes.
You broke your parents in.
Oh, yeah.
And what did your dad do?
He was a fisherman.
Coincidentally.
About storytelling, I grew up in a family that told stories. I mean, it's what we did for entertainment. We did have a television, but, you know, with only three television stations, you know, who wanted to watch that? Yeah. And so that's what we did. We sat around, and when my great uncle, he was a market gardener, he would come every week and stay at our house, and that was entertainment. So we knew these stories. We knew the old folk tales, mostly from the Caribbean, the ones from Africa. And it was a ritual on weekends, telling stories. And, you know, we didn't sit around the fire, or grandma wasn't in the rocking chair, or any of that nonsense that people try to promote. But it was just family. As we're sitting around here today, somebody starts talking about something, and the next thing you know, somebody throws a story in, and somebody, and one of the kids might say, tell us about so-and-so. And there were stories we all knew. The story, like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, we knew the songs that went to the story. We knew the actions that went to the story. So we would act these stories. We would be waiting for the cue so we could get up and yell, for example, Chalamukachugam! 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 And the storyteller would say, and what does that mean? And we would say, it means run! Tiger's behind you! Run! Tiger's behind you! Run! Tiger's behind you! So it was very, very interactive. And whether it was the old African stories or whether it was Greek mythology or whatever, I just grew up in a storytelling environment and just continued that.
Oh, I'm Arnie Sand. My lady friend rang me up. Her roommate was going to move to somewhere off of Seattle, and there was furniture involved. And would I loan her, well, not loan her the truck, loan me and the truck together to take all this luggage and baggage and then up to Seattle? Well, what else am I doing? Sure. So we set out, just Myra and me and all the furniture. The other friend is already up there, somewhere east of Seattle. Well, I discovered that Myra has a GPS, and I'd never had one of those before. And GPSs were great. It always knew where we were, and Myra showed me how to operate it. And when we got to Seattle the next day, you know, I'm going to set out. And Myra and I decided I should not take the ferry. We should go around it. It would work out better. And so she programmed this GPS to do this. And then I would get over to my cousin's house, and I'm going to stay 2 or 3 days with him, and then I'm going to come down to visit my other cousin in Molala. Now, I didn't know everything I was supposed to know about Molala. But anyway, the next day we got it all lost off, and I'm sitting off, and right off, the lady in the GPS says, recalculating route. Oh, well, isn't that nice? Recalculating route. Well, you know what that told me? That told me that I had taken the wrong directions and she was going to fix it. Then it was recalculating route. This lady was getting peeved at me. And I took the ferry. We were not supposed to take the ferry. She was punishing me because that was $7 to take the ferry. Well, we get over to Seattle. I'm not quite sure where I'm going. And she says, make a right turn. I said, lady, there's two of them. I took one. It was the wrong one. Suddenly, I was on 14th Street, headed into downtown Seattle, a marvelous view. Best view of downtown Seattle. And then she said, make a legal U-turn at your first opportunity. And I said, lady, this is an 8-lane road. And I pulled over into the dead man lane. Well, you know how these ladies on the GPS are. If the car's not moving, they're not talking to you. And now I'm in the middle of the dead man lane. I'm scared to go to the right. The cars are going like this. I'll get rear-ended. And if I go to the left, I'll get broadsided. I don't dare move. I'm trapped. And then, all of a sudden, coming up on the right, comes this great big semi. Barreled past me, and about a block down, it made a hard right turn. I could hear the brakes screaming, and I made a legal U-turn. The lady never said another word to me. I got to my cousin's house with no further ado. Well, I stayed a couple days, and then I'm set off to visit my other cousin in Molalla. I didn't know everything you're supposed to know about Molalla. I get to Molalla. She's talking to me. Everything's great, you know. I'm making myself okay. Everything good. But when I got to Molalla, she would not take the address I wanted to go to. It would not come up. So I'm stopping the car. I'm asking people. And people are piling up behind me, honking their horns and screaming. Screaming at me. I have never been... It stopped. Had never had so many people screaming at me in my entire life. And I don't know where to go. I stop. I ask a fellow. He's picking cucumbers in the front yard there on the main street. I ask a number of people. I finally get to the right street, Molden Bridge. And there's a burned out house over here. So I go over there. And I said to those people, I said, I'm looking for this address. And they said, it's the house across the street. And I said, you mean that burned out house, that abandoned house? And they said, yes, that's where you're going. Well, I went over there and my cousin's remodeling. So that was where I was going. So I set up the pup tent and me and the dog, we got along fine. The GPS is not talking to me, not a word. Well, so the next day my cousin feeds me and sends me on my way and I look around at Molalla. You know, very pleasant, the grass is green, and I think there's aliens living under Molalla. But I don't know why I thought there were aliens living under Molalla. I stop at the road stop, and in Oregon, every road stop was full. I had to park at the last space. But when I got to California, I could park the car in the road stops anywhere I wanted. They were empty. So I got home in good shape. And the next day was a Toastmaster meeting. And I went to the meeting and I said to one of my Toastmaster friends, I've been to Molalla. And he said, Molalla? That's where Bigfoot lives. And I said, Bigfoot? He said, yes, Bigfoot lives in Molalla. And that's when I realized who it was that had been screaming at me. The aliens of Molalla are teaching Bigfoot how to drive. He's the one that was screaming at me. And you folk, take note of this. Because if someday you're out and all of a sudden your GPS says, recalculating route, and it's a male voice, you better hang in there for the long haul, because that means that Bigfoot has learned how to drive cars, he has learned how to drive spaceships, and he is now driving the planet to a cooler orbit. Make sure you have a blanket in the back of the car.
What was your first adventure, your first road trip? How young were you?
When I was young, my father was from Wisconsin, and every summer his 2-week vacation, I didn't know that at the time, every summer his 2-week vacation consisted of us getting in the old 36 Ford, I think it was, and driving to Wisconsin. It would take 5 days.
Yeah.
We would spend 3, and it would take 5 days to get back. I would get car sick. they would have to pull over and let me out, and I would walk around the car several times, and then I would get over it. But by that time, another car would have arrived, and then another car. And I have mental visions of there'd be 10 or 15 cars. They had all pulled over. What's wrong? Do you need help? Do you need something? Is your car... You know, that doesn't happen anymore.
No.
Not at all. But in those days, probably somewhere around 1940, every car that came by and you were stopped alongside the road, they stopped. Everybody got acquainted. It was kind of fun, actually. Well, I was about 9 or 10, but as I said, I got car sick and they would have to stop and let me out.
And there's a lot of stories that you would hear. As you said, people would get to know each other.
Yeah, but I didn't know to pay attention at that time.
Of course not. But those seeds were planted.
Yes. But it always amazed me now to realize that my father's two-week vacation consisted of 5 days driving to his parents and 5 days driving back. 3 days is all we ever spent at the relatives.
That was probably enough.
It probably was. I think my mother was ready to go home.
Yeah, in-laws being what they are.
Right. My father had gone to Wisconsin. He was from Wisconsin. He'd gone to Idaho. He'd gotten a job making cheese. He was a cheesemaker. And one night he went home to his parents' house and he says, "We're going to Idaho." And they left that night in a blizzard. And my grandfather told his wife, "Don't lock the door. They'll be back." But he wasn't. They left the car in Colorado, but they got to Idaho and Pa set up a cheese factory. And of course, later he met my mother and we stayed in Idaho. But every summer I remember 5 days going.
Let's all say it together.
5 days going. 5 days coming back.
We did it every other year, Arnie. And it was Colorado to Pennsylvania.
We stopped in Colorado.
It was the same trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. My name is Lawrence Crayson. I'm a blind storyteller from Sacramento. And my story is a true story, believe it or not. In 1985, my mother, my mother-in-law, my son, all took a trip up to Oregon. Now, my dad had a saying that if it hailed in California, that was just Oregon dew, because he went to college in Eugene. Well, we were supposed to meet my mother-in-law's relatives in Portland, and we're going to meet halfway in Bandon, Oregon, on the coast. And it was 4th of July weekend. My son drove, my wife, myself, and a dog were in the Subaru station wagon. And it wasn't that old, and it was really a neat car. But we went up Highway 5 to Redding and over the coast to Eureka. Well, that trip from Redding to Eureka, which normally takes about 2 hours, took us about 5 hours. And I'll tell you why. When we got on that mountain road, it was a two-lane road, switchbacks back and forth. It was up and down hills. We discovered what a fuel filter was. In a car like ours, there's a little filter that filters out the fuel and it keeps all the rots and everything out of the engine. Well, we didn't know that fuel filter hadn't been cleaned ever since we bought the car. So when we were going up the hills, the car would go chuk, 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 and we had a whole line of cars behind us. When we got top of the hill and came down, zoom, down the hill, you know, chuk, 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 chuk. Well, we get to Eureka, 4th of July weekend. We didn't want to call the dealership, because it would be an arm and a leg. But we had to resort to call the dealership, because no one else was open. And he said, "Well, you probably have to leave the car here for the weekend, because there's no one hardly open. Now, if it's a fuel filter, there's a guy across town that will fix it. Probably $10, you'll be on your way." So all the way across town in Eureka, we said, "Whatever a fuel filter is, let it be a fuel filter." He got underneath our car, pulled out this little fuel filter, couldn't even blow air through it, and looked up and said, "How long have you been, how long since you've changed this fuel filter?" It was 60,000 miles on the car. We had never changed it. He said, "You're supposed to change it every 10,000 miles. When we got in the car and we zoomed up to Bandon, it was like a whole different car. We get up there, we're supposed to camp out in this Boulder State Park campground. My wife and I's view of camping out is Motel 6. We have never camped in a tent since 1985. I had never slept in a tent, and I pitched the tent in a wrong place, in a low spot. My son, his cousin, me, and my wife were in this tent. Now, my wife was a smart one. She had like four pads, high and dry. Her little poodles on there, they were fine. My son, his cousin, and me got sopping wet because that night it rained. My mother-in-law was in a motorhome, and she couldn't sleep at all either because of metal rain and wobbling back and forth. She said, "I want to go home." Well, we convinced her to drive around and let's see if we can find a hotel. On 4th of July weekend, we find this beautiful family-run hotel, which still is there today, Sunset Motel. And we got there. They had one room left for that night only. $37 for four of us. My wife booted me out of the bed the next morning. Said, "Let's go down and see if there's a cancellation for the next day." Sure enough, they said, "Well, you have to move downstairs underneath the road, looking out the beach." $42, 1985. Nowadays, those same rooms cost $120, $160 in the summertime. But it's a wonderful resort. On that weekend, my wife was walking along the beach, and my mother-in-law was up on the balcony looking at everybody walking along. And a lady came up beside her and said, "You see that lady up there? She's so nosy. She's watching everybody along the beach." And my wife couldn't resist. She said, "You know, I've been telling my mother about that, and she shouldn't be doing that." I'm sorry. But that's the way my wife is, spontaneous. But we had a beautiful weekend. It didn't rain anymore that weekend, but I'll always remember the chuck, 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 and the rain on the campground. Thank you. Like I said, I'm a storyteller from Sacramento. I've been storytelling, I didn't know it at the time, but when I had my eye operations in San Francisco, they had patched my eyes and I couldn't watch TV. So I told stories to my roommate about the neighbors, the nurses, the doctors, and everybody, and we just made up stories. That's the first time I remember telling stories. My wife got involved in children's theater, and one of the directors and playwrights was a member of the Sacramento Storytellers Guild, and she sashayed up to me and said, "You know, you would be a great storyteller. You don't have to wear makeup. You don't have to wear a costume. Just come on over and tell stories." Hey, that sounds great. So that's how I got involved.
Fun.
Yes.
So you're talking about the operation. How old were you?
I was just turning 9 when I was hit straight on with the basketball playing dodgeball in school and DHS my right eye. My left eye was affected when I was born because I was a premature baby and 2 pounds, 9 ounces, 2 months premature, and they didn't know that too much oxygen affected babies' eyes at that time. So I've always been blind, but I used to ride a bicycle, I used to play frisbee, and I don't do that anymore because it's gotten worse. But I really love to tell stories, and my dad was a librarian at City College here, and he used to read me stories about Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer and all those.
Yeah.
And it was just it stimulated the imagination because I couldn't see a lot, my mind would just send these pictures through my head about, you know, imagining these things. So because I enjoy storytelling, I can say I have a balloon here, and about 10 different people could say, "Well, it's a red balloon." "No, it's a red, green balloon, white balloon." It allows them to have the imagination. So that's why I appreciate it.
Absolutely. My father is an avid listener of the old radio shows.
Yes.
And that's, I was first born, and so I was weaned on
drama. Yeah, your imagination. Yeah.
And he ultimately became a trial attorney, so he obviously needed an audience.
Well, I have 2 grandkids who are now 6 foot tall, 17 and 16. And I used to tell them bedtime stories, and I told them a story from India that was a folk tale. And they told me back the whole story with pictures of, you know, how the king looked and everything.
Nice.
And I told them, you know, "I didn't tell you where it was from." And they had it all, white people in England and so on. And they said, "What if I told you this story was from India?" He said, "Oh, yeah, that would be a lot different." You know? So their little minds were perking along with the stories and the visualization. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah. Good job, Grandpa.
Thank you.
Like, first, to tell you about how I came to be a storyteller. Is that okay?
Sure.
My father used to tell stories. His stories were always the kind that began with, well, it seems that, and then he'd have a whole, what they called a shaggy dog story that would go on, on and on and on. And he was also able to, you know, do different kinds of voices, different accents and things like that. Some of his stories I've told here at the Storytellers Guild. So that gave me my start towards storytelling. But when I grew up and went to college, I decided to be a children's librarian. And I was a children's librarian for about 40 years. And part of being a children's librarian is telling stories, mainly folk tales. So that's how I got really into telling stories myself. Now, the story I'm going to tell you is one of the first stories that I ever told. Actually, was the final exam in the College Storytelling Guild, a storytelling course that I took as part of my library. I had an MLS in storytelling, Master of Library Science. Anyway, this is the first story that I ever told as a storyteller. Once upon a time, near the city of Accra, on the Gulf of Guinea, a countryman went into his garden to dig yams for market. And as he dug, one of his yams said to him, "Well, here you are at last. You never weeded me, but now you come around with your digging stick. Go away and leave me alone." The astonished man looked at his cow. "Did you say something?" The cow didn't say anything at all, but just kept on chewing its cud. But the man's dog spoke up. The dog said, "It wasn't the cow that spoke to you. It was the yam. The yam says, 'Leave me alone.'" Well, this made the man angry, because his dog had never spoken before, and he didn't like the tone of voice it took. So he broke a branch from a tree to beat his dog. But just then the tree said, "Hey, put that branch down." And so he started to throw the branch away, but the branch said, "Man, put me down softly." So he laid it gently down upon a stone. But then the stone said, "Hey, take that thing off me." Well, that was enough for the farmer. He started running towards his village. And as he went along, he met a fisherman who came along carrying a fish trap on his head. "Where are you going in such a hurry?" said the fisherman. "Oh, I've just had such a terrible experience. My yam said, 'Leave me alone.' I was digging yams, and he said, 'Leave me alone.' And my dog said, 'Listen to what your yam says.' When I went to beat the dog, the tree said, 'Put that branch down.' And the branch said, 'Do it softly.' And then the stone said, 'Hey, take that thing off me.'" "Is that why you're running so fast?" asked the fisherman. "Well," said his fish trap, "did he take it off?" The fisherman gave a yell and he threw his fish trap down on the ground. And he ran off with the farmer. And as they ran, they came across a weaver who was coming along in the opposite direction with a big bundle of cloth on his head. "Where are you guys running in such a hurry?" said the weaver. "My yam said, 'Leave me alone.' And my dog said, 'Listen to what your yam says.' The tree said, 'Put that branch down.' And the branch said, 'Do it softly.' And then the stone said, 'Hey, take that thing off me.'" "And yes," said the fisherman, "my fish trap said, 'Did he?'" "Oh, that's no reason to be running," said the weaver. "No reason at all." "Oh, yes, it is," said his bundle of cloth. "You'd run too if it happened to you." The weaver gave a yell and he threw his bundle of cloth down on the path and he ran off with the others. Well, they ran till they came to a ford in the river, and there was a man who was bathing in the water. And he looked up as he saw them running along and he said, "Are you men chasing a gazelle? My yam said, 'Leave me alone.' And my dog said, listen to the yam. The tree said, put that branch down. And the branch said, do it softly. And then the stone said, hey, take that thing off me. Yes, said the fisherman. My fish trap said, did he? Yes, said the weaver. My bundle of cloth said, you'd run too. Is that why you're running so fast? Asked the man in the river. You'd run too if it happened to you, said the river. Well, the man in the river gave a yell and jumped out of the water, and he ran off with the others. They ran till they came to their village, and they ran down the main street until they came to the house of the chief. And the chief's servants brought his stool out for him, carved stool, for him to sit on while he listened to their complaints. I was digging yams in my garden, began the farmer, when suddenly everything began to talk. My yams said, go away and leave me alone. And when my dog said, listen to what your yam says. When I went to beat the dog, the tree said, put that branch down. And the branch said, do it softly. And then the stone said, hey, take that thing off me. Yes, said the fisherman. My fish trap said, did he? Yes, said the weaver. My bundle of cloth said, you'd run too. And the river said the same thing, said the man who had been bathing. The chief listened to all this with a scowl. This is really a ridiculous tale, he said. You men had better go back to your work before I fine you for disturbing the peace. So the men went back to their work, and the chief muttered to himself, silly tales like that, they just upset the community. Ridiculous, isn't it? Agreed his stool. Imagine a talking yam.
Barney, I have a little codicil to my story.
Okay.
If I could say that real quick. The moral to Gail's story is plants and animals should stop yammering.
Okay.
This is a codicil to my story. As you know, we had a Kentucky Derby, a Triple Crown winner for the first time since Secretariat, not since Secretariat, but in 37 years, right? 2 weeks ago, American Pharoah won the Triple Crown. His jockey was scared of horses when he was a child. Well, I've been scared of horses ever since Tornado took me for a ride. And when I heard that a Triple Crown winning jockey was scared of horses when he was a child, I picked up the phone and called the therapeutic riding stables in Dixon and said, I'd like to volunteer. I think it's time for me to get over that.
Nice.
Did you notice that there were memories of parents telling them stories when they were children? I encourage all of you parents out there to tell stories to your children, whether you're reading from a book or creating them with your imagination. Do something different. Next time you're on a trip, send postcards to the children in your family. Yours, your nieces and nephews, they'll get a kick out of receiving something in the mail just for them.